Hey, it's Tom here, and welcome back to another episode of the Investing with Tom podcast. Now, this time we have a popular guest returning for, I believe, episode number 3, and that is Matt Peterson of Peterson Capital Management. Last time we did an episode with Matt was actually at his home in Austin, Texas, following the 2022 Berkshire meeting. That was a heck of a lot of fun. And like I say, Matt's a popular guest, so we've got him back for round 3. Now, in this episode, we go very deep on Seritage Growth Properties. That is a company that Matt had exposure through shares and options, effectively to 1% of the overall Seritage company. He was a pretty big shareholder in that business for a relatively modest size fund that he runs as well. So a lot of detail on Seritage in this episode. Matt's thoughts on that particular company have changed quite substantially. We also talk through the Daily Journal Corporation. Charlie Munger recently had the DJ Co annual meeting, talked about Alibaba being an investment mistake amongst other things, so we cover off that. And we also put a lot of audience questions from Twitter to Matt in this episode as well. Now, I try to say this on basically any video or podcast that I do where we talk about an individual stock, but I really want to stress it in this one in particular because we go into a lot of detail with a individual company in this episode. But genuinely, everything in this episode is purely educational, entertainment purposes only. This isn't intended to make you buy or sell any particular stock or anything like that. If you're interested in transacting on one of these companies, potentially, please do your own work and your own research. And if you're not comfortable doing that yourself, of course, reach out to a qualified professional. But with all that said, let's roll this episode with Matt Peterson, and I hope you enjoy. Matt Peterson returns for episode number 3. I'm pretty sure this is the third appearance. It seems like almost a year has flown by very quickly since we recorded where you're currently sitting in Austin. So very happy to have you back and finally get this episode in. So how are you going?
Thank you, Tom. It's great to see you again. It's nice to be here. And congratulations to you. You are recently a new father.
I am, yes. I was just telling you before this, I had sort of probably 50% of my usual sleep hours last night. So if I say something really dumb during this podcast, that's my excuse up front. But thank you. I appreciate that. We've got a lot to go through today. We were sort of just chatting through some of the bullet points of topics I've got for this episode before we hit record here. And there's a lot of stuff to dive into. Some pretty big developments on your front with Seritage Growth Properties, which we've covered, I think, in both of the previous times we've had you on the show. But maybe just up front, I think it'd be interesting to at least get your thoughts on share some words on what's currently happening in Turkey at the moment. We had initially planned to record this podcast maybe a couple of weeks ago, but obviously some pretty devastating events happening in Turkey. I know your wife's Turkish. I know you've got Turkish friends and investments as well. And I think you're in Switzerland at the time that was all happening at a ValueX conference from memory. So do you want to just kind of chat through?
What can I say about Turkey? I think most of your viewers have seen in the headlines that there were some devastating earthquakes. Obviously, there's, different humanitarian crises happening all over the world. But this was a little bit shocking because it was there were multiple earthquakes in the same region, the same few cities, one after another. And what has happened is that despite, the tens and thousands of people that have died and the many tens of thousands that are missing, is that the ones who survived also cannot get back into their homes and things. The infrastructure is very fragile. So the humanitarian crisis is very real. And it's a devastating time. We Mesut Alioğlu, who's the portfolio manager for the Talis Fund, which is completely invested in Turkey, is in Istanbul and lives in Istanbul. I will say the people we know directly, we know people who are very indirectly impacted. Fortunately, we haven't suffered any direct loss of family or friends, but Masood, for example, I know he has a family hotel and they are currently housing people. And I think if anybody wants to help, they can reach out to him. His email address is just M-E, Masood Taliotolu, M-E at talascapital.com. So I'm sure he'd be happy to hear some encouraging words. And I know it's a really, really challenging time there. However, I will add that it's very difficult from a humanitarian perspective, which is why I think it was important that we delayed this a few weeks. But economically, the regions that are impacted are on the Far East. So they're the regions that are near Syria. They're sort of these bordering cities, and there's very little economic activity. It's not like a devastating economic impact. It's a humanitarian impact. So the Turkey economy will be just fine. And, you know, there's actually a lot of interesting catalysts in the region. I think you've heard through many podcasts over the last year or two about how inexpensive and the incredible opportunities there. So there are there are significant opportunities in Turkey. It is the cheapest market in the world. It's amazing how you can get these great businesses that are, say, exporting quality goods in dollar or euros, but all of their costs are based in lira. So they're having their costs are going down while their revenue and earnings are going up. And then as they're traded on the Borsa Stock Exchange, those prices are incredibly low trading in lira. So the opportunities economically in Turkey are quite great, but the devastation that they're suffering right now is significant. And so we're very conscious of sort of the rhetoric we put out, because it's a very real crisis happening there.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I'll leave Masood's email in the description below for anyone that didn't catch that or wants to check spelling or anything down the description.
Terrific,
below.
Terrific. But,
yeah, thanks for sharing.
And thanks for asking and thinking about it. I mean, you know, some folks out there don't quite know the devastation, but I believe there's around 50,000 fatalities at this point, which is, it's astronomical. It's getting up there with sort of the Ukraine war and things. So it's a very big problem.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. I mean, I've seen a small fraction of that living in New Zealand. We're directly on a fault line, and you know, the western side of our South Island is mountain ranges, so we're certainly no strangers to earthquakes, but that is that's a very, very big one. So
And it has you know, unfortunately it has a lot to do with sort of the infrastructure and protocols, and you know, some of the buildings are just simply not structurally sound. So in New Zealand you may not have the same type of devastation. These are in some cases century, millennia old structures, and they're just collapsing.
Yeah, we're certainly heading in the right direction with as things have been rebuilt over the years and that type of thing. So hopefully Turkey can pull off something similar. Right, Matt, let's get into some of the more highly requested topics, I would say, for this episode. Let's start off with Seritage Growth Properties. I think this is one we've discussed a couple of times. You sent me a really interesting presentation that you gave at ValueX earlier in the year on Seritage and kind of how you were thinking about that at the time. And you sort of laid out like quite an interesting way to play the Seritage liquidation I guess it's a liquidation arbitrage type setup with fairly long-term put options, selling fairly long-term put options, the idea that strike prices get adjusted and that type of thing. Maybe we can get into the specifics on that exact, you know, way of approaching something like Seritage shortly. But did you want to give us just a general update on how you're thinking about SRG at the moment? Because it sounds like, I won't spoil it, but it sounds like some things may have changed a little
bit. Yeah. So the bombshell is, so I, of course, did send you that presentation. I have seen it floating around a little bit. People are talking about a little on Twitter. So why don't I give you a little bit of context? We'll go back a bit and just share, you know, we have been tirelessly valuing these individual properties over and over a series of years. And we began this process when there were 212. Now that there are only 78 or 80 or 85, depending on which numbers you're looking at, remaining, it seems really manageable. It's still a lot of work, but it's still really, now it's manageable. There's only 80 left, and we've done this quite a few times. So at the end of last year, we were dealing in Q3 numbers. So, you know, that's all that we have from management. We have their statements that they're going to be paying out the 18 to 28, et cetera. And we have the values of the individual properties as we've assigned them. And they're not all accurate, but they're close. And, you know, our errors may be, you know, our errors underestimating one may be overestimated on another. They tend to balance out pretty well. So we're really confident in our numbers. And so what we recognized with this liquidation arb play, because we've been in Seritage for a while, is that there seemed to be a real opportunity to write puts and pick up a premium. And there's an interesting aspect to it all. So why don't I just talk through what happens? So when you're, we are regular sellers of puts as a tool to buy equity. So this is nothing foreign to any of our process previously. What we've recognized is that this is a situation with a clear end date. In October of 2023, October of 2022, they announced their strategic alternative plan, which was to liquidate the remaining assets, pay off their debt, the $800 billion to Berkshire Hathaway, the final preferred shares, cover their operating expenses, and distribute all remaining assets to the equity holders, and the company would be liquidated. And so with that knowledge in hand, we know that there's a time frame until October of 2024 when this has to take place. And then there's a caveat where some of the properties could be taken private into a private trust and then wound down from that point. So that's the information we have to work with. And we know the price, we know the properties that are available for sale. And for your audience, if they don't know this, we see them disappear from the website far in advance to what happens in the financial statements. So ultimately, in our valuations, we understood that it looked like, you know, it didn't look like they were going to reach the 18 to 28 figure that management keeps saying. And we understand they have ambition to do so, but unless things change drastically, we just don't see the value there. But we did for a while see 12 to 18 or 12 to 15. And we're a little conservative in our numbers because we want to be, we want to have that margin of safety. So ultimately, Tom, we proposed this liquidation arbitrage where basically you could sell. At the time we were completing the presentation and we were doing this, we were writing puts for a $12 strike that would go out to, say, January of 2025, post the time frame when the stock will no longer be traded on the exchange. So past the end date, we were able to be paid $2 a share for those. And what I think a lot of people don't recognize is the way the Chicago Board of Exchange historically handles sort of special dividends or mergers or corporate events is the CBOE has to make a ruling on how they're going to handle the option treatment. So you can't commit to say, for simplicity, if you want to buy a call on a firm and then they have and they divest half of the firm, your call is now gives you access to both entities, not just the single entity where you'd previously purchased the option. Yeah. So with Seritage, when they start paying a large special dividend, you know, a typical dividend would be ignored, but a special dividend will not be ignored by the Chicago Board of Exchange. So when this happens, they'll make a ruling, and the ruling will be that they will reduce the strike price of both puts and calls for the amount that was paid out per share. So if Seritage starts paying out $3 per quarter at the end of this year. And they do that for the next four quarters. We'll receive $12 in payment, but notably the strike price of our $12 put will go to zero. We now have to buy the put back, and the strike price is, of course, zero. So the stock isn't going to go below that strike price, so it becomes arbitrage. We keep the premium, and of course, if they pay out 13, 14, or 15, we wouldn't get those payments, but we would just keep the premium. That started to look pretty attractive. In fact, it started to look more attractive from my perspective than the risk return of holding the shares. Because to hold the shares at a price of, say, 12, or at the time, maybe it was even 12.50, we saw very little. The upside is capped. They're not going to magically create new properties. And so that was our thesis. And we sort of switched into this liquidation R because it looked like our conservative numbers were definitely going to deliver this amount of capital. However, Tom, our thesis continues to evolve. Interrupt me if I'm going too long here, but
yeah, I just had one quick question before we move on to the next point, Matt. The strike price adjustment from the Chicago Board of Exchange, is that a certainty that would happen if a special dividend was paid out, or is that somewhat up in the air?
Anything can happen, Tom. So I wouldn't say it's 100% certainty, but it would be irrational for them to conclude any other measure than to lower the strike price. If what they're, there's 56 million shares outstanding. So for them just to suddenly do a special dividend of like $600 million and then not adjust the prices, would cause issues. So I think it's near 100%, but they have to make the ruling. The ruling is not out. But that is certainly what they have done in the past and what I would expect. That's best practices. That's the precedent, and that's what they should do moving forward. But having that information is very important. It's interesting to think that people are possibly transacting in these things without, some opinion on how the Chicago Board of Exchange will handle this. Because of course, if they pay out all the money to shareholders, the share price is going to fall. They're going to have less value remaining. So if nothing's adjusted with your puts, you're going to be buying a quickly, a company that's quickly devaluing for a pre-stated price, and that would not be correct. So we think it's very, very likely that that is the outcome.
Gotcha. Cool. No, thanks for that. I'll let you continue on with your continued reevaluation of
securities. It's a little bit. I think things are controversial at the moment, and the thesis really is evolving. But I might as well share with you that, in large part, based on the year-end business update, which was not something that was, we sort of knew it was coming, but that's not a standard memo for the business to deliver. They're supposed to be delivering earnings and the annual report later this month. So that was an interesting bit of information. And based on the charts that they provided, based on the prices that we've predetermined, we started looking at their expected, their sales schedule, and recognizing that the situation is cracking. I think the commercial real estate debt market is showing signs of uncertainty. I listened to Powell's testimony to Congress for the last couple of days. And although we don't base our investment decisions on these macro factors, Seritage is very different because it's in liquidation. We have about a year and a half and if the environment doesn't look promising during the next year and a half, sales will be delayed, prices will be down. Demand, you know, for these commercial real estate properties seems to be going in the wrong direction. Every time we raise interest rates, we should be raising the cap rates. So new developers are less willing to pay as much. And it seems to me that Powell is determined to get inflation under control, which means continuing to raise interest rates. And the landscape for commercial real estate doesn't look very promising. We've revalued a lot of these. And unfortunately, I don't think, look, there's a possibility that it's successful, that you can get your $12. I think it's almost impossible for them to get 18. And in fact, by our numbers that we keep recalculating, I think it's much more likely, Tom, that we receive, and we don't receive, but the shareholders receive about $3 to $8 possibly over the next few years, with a number of the properties going into the private trust, which means those won't be sold. And I'm happy to walk you through the numbers here in a second, which means the payout won't occur probably until 2026, which with the time value of money, you would think it would then sell at a discount to those expected prices. So I think the upside of the shares at this price have now, our thesis has really shifted. And the upside is muted. We were aware of that already, but it seems like the downside is becoming much greater. And it's really, everyone needs to do their own research, but I think the risk reward is deteriorating with this situation. And the potential is that the shares could go a whole lot lower.
Do you think that would have, do you think the numbers would have been very different and you'd still be in this thing if, you know, we were still talking about 4.5% and 5% cap rates on a lot of these properties? Is that really the 100% major change here?
Absolutely. There's secondary effects that happen when the rates go up. One is that the ability to access these debt markets declines. So as rates go up, there's fewer and fewer participants that are able to bid and make the payments on these large buildings. So demand just automatically starts declining. And then it's really a buyer's market. It gives the buyer all sorts of credible reasons why they shouldn't be paying previous prices. So prices are definitely slipping. And I think people underestimate how much they're impacted. If I were to give you some very high level number, you look at Seritage. They now, after their recent payment in February, owe $800 million to Berkshire, and they owe $80 million to their preferred shareholders. And they've set out a schedule in the year-end business review where they say, you know, they're going to sell something like 50 properties worth less than $10 million. Well, I can look at my list of properties. It doesn't mean they're getting $10 million for these. It means they're going to get about what we think they're going to receive. You know, if you assume that they're getting a very high value, and by the way, 17 of these properties were already sold. So you can't account for all new properties. At that point, you recognize they have $1 billion that they need to pay in Berkshire debt, preferred debt, and some interest and some OPEX, some CAPEX. If they have $1 billion to pay, we do not see them selling $1 billion in properties this year. What does that mean? That means the dividend doesn't come this year. All right. So I think we're very early in recognizing that there are cracks. And I think we're going to be, it's a little like dominoes, and we just have a long line of bad news coming. We have remove the position from our portfolio. Doesn't mean you can't sell a $5 put and maybe make money, but the shares seem to have, if you just do the math and you assume they can get eight, and that if they take AdVentura, Redmond, or a couple of you know, premier properties into this liquidation trust? How much per share do they have? If AdVentura is $150 million, just by taking that single mall, they've taken $3 into the liquidation trust. So that means no distribution. So if we're getting eight with everything, we could end up with them taking six of that into a liquidation trust. Now, what do they pay out shareholders? Two? So if shareholders recognize, when they recognize that the distributions aren't coming, and they're not going to come in Q4, and they probably won't come in Q1, the shares will sell off dramatically. And we know from past, John Gorelli's done this in the past with Lubies and things, the share price will sell likely at a 30% discount to property NAV as it goes into liquidation. So if they bring $6 in, the shares probably sell at $4 or less. Part of that is just uncertainty. Some of that is having, you know, the time value of money. It's going to sell at a slight discount. So if they pay out two and the shares are going to go into a liquidation trust at maybe four, and this is kind of the high end of our range now, that seems like a $6 value next year, late next year, because you could sell the stock for four. So maybe shares are worth five today. That's our thesis.
Well, that's a major change from not that long ago, really, where it was probably three times that, right?
Even more. And we recognize it. Look, we do reserve the right to change our mind, and the facts are changing. So, you know, and part of it is hard to go on these, but, you know, we've talked about this before, this commitment consistency and going out there with your holdings and talking publicly. One, we need to be able to change our mind, which we did change our mind. So I think it was I think we're successful in that area. That's fine. So, but this story is I think rapidly changing. Tom, 2 years ago when we talked, or maybe even longer, we valued 212 and we've had $27 a share. And we received pushback on that figure. Okay. That figure seemed low to many, including, you know, value investors, successful value investors, it seemed low. But we were being conservative. We then moved that number to about 18 when management came out last year and said they'd pay out 18 to 28. We moved it to 18 with math. We revalued the properties and we adjusted cap rates, and we looked at what rents were going for, and we looked at the demographics. It's a huge exercise. And we add up all the properties and we subtract all payments and debt, and we divide by 56 million shares outstanding. We had $18 a share. So at that point, it was fine to hold stock for 12, fine to sell puts and pick up premiums. But we've now seen it. We then saw it around 12, 13 last year, and now we're seeing it deteriorate. So we've gone from 27 to 18 to 13, and now we're going lower. And, it's just a trend that I think we're very early. I think people need to do their own work. But, you know, value the big ones. If you're out there trying to figure out, you know, value AdVentura, I'll tell you, we've got it at about 150 million, but you can look at Redmond, you can look at Houston, you can look at, UTC. If you value the premieres, that's where the money is. They're selling everything else, and they're going to pay back the debt with that. I don't think there's a liquidity issue at all, by the way. They're going to get their 800 million. They're going to get their billion. By our calculations, which in some cases are too low, you know, let me know what you think Redmond's worth. What would a developer pay for Redmond is the question. We all know it's worth a lot. It's a hugely valuable property right down the street from Microsoft. They're doing a lot of, you know, this mixed commercial use. They're expanding it. They're doing the densification. They've got entitlements. But what does a developer pay is the question. What will they pay for Seritage? And I don't want to go on so long here on a monologue, but I'll add a couple of little aspects that... So one thing is, I think anybody who is valuing the properties and doing this little arithmetic. They're not recognizing that every bit of revenue doesn't go all the way to the bottom line and pay off debt. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, whether it's a fee to Barclays or other staging costs, there are costs affiliated with it. And, you know, something like 80% or so might be more realistic. Further, the properties that they've sold thus far have been selling at a loss. And so there hasn't been any taxable gains. Depending on how things move going forward, the sales of the big properties will have capital gains. And if there aren't sufficient losses to offset those, there will actually be a tax liability as well. So Seritage could pay taxes on the revenue they receive, then have the costs, and the final amount that they bring in is far below the sale price. So by our estimates, Tom, I'll tell you, we estimate about 1 point. If I tell you the real number, it'll sound low. We estimate 1.2 to 1.5 billion in assets. And we see them having about $1 billion that they need to pay off in a short period of time. So, you know, if they have 500 million and there's 56 million shares outstanding, you can do the math. It comes to about 11. So, could they get a little more by selling some out parcels and things? Maybe a little bit, but not much. This isn't magic. They can't just make up property. So that's our new thesis, Tom.
Well, that's the bombshell, isn't it? It's been a really interesting one to follow. I've been following this for a few years now as well. It seems like it's been a bit of a perfect combination over the past few years of, or especially over the past 12 months of, you know, increasing cap rates or declining property values, combined with a bunch of leverage, combined with the fact that they haven't had, you know, they've had sort of negative operating cash flows, and it's sort of just steadily eaten away at the net asset value for a few years now, hasn't it?
That's right. I think what folks don't see clearly all the time is that the operating leverage that they're operating with, it causes massive swings in the equity. And look, we were involved in Horsehead years ago. I think there's a few things that I see that are just similar. And it's like, you know, an asset, all these assets that are sort of deteriorating in value, and there's all this hopefulness going on in the market. But the reality is the equity holders are the lowest on the whole cap structure. Debt holders get paid first. The preferred shareholders are going to get paid first. They're going to run the businesses first. Andrea Olson's going to get her bonus first. And then what's left is going to come to the equity holders. And look, I don't think management's doing a poor job. I think they're doing well. I think they're doing the best they possibly can. So this isn't about management making mistakes. This is about them operating in a super challenging environment where everything from e-commerce to the pandemic hit them before, you know, these mall assets are losing value. AMC, as their, you know, one of their clients, losing value. You know, a number of their main customers are losing value. So Seritage has a lot of subtle challenges. And because of $1 billion in sort of operating leverage, a simple change of 10% of their real estate puts them in a big bind. In fact, every 10% move is like a $3 per share move. And you can see if interest rates go up in the US by 25 or 50 bips here this month and then continue a little bit more, we're going to have that downward pressure. There are a lot of headwinds. There don't seem to be many tailwinds, and there is a deadline coming up in just 18 months where the company will cease to exist and they'll take the remaining assets private, and the market at that point will sell at a discount to those private assets.
Yeah, it's an interesting point you brought up there around management as well. I was actually going to ask you before you said that, if you were running Seritage or maybe took it over, I think Andrea Olson came in 2020 from memory. possibly 2019.
Yeah, probably 2020. Maybe a little at the end of 2020.
Yeah, I was basically going to ask you, would you have done anything different if you were running the show at Seeritage? Or you think...
Look, they did...
They just got a bad...
It's so challenging. It's a fine question to ask. I think Andrea did a fine job. She increased transparency. The market was really uncertain. And at the time, they were trying to get property-level financing. I think they had a number of tools to use, and they explored them all. And at the end, they realized the strategic alternative to sell these off was going to yield the highest results. And again, Tom, I could be wrong. It's, when you're valuing a $4 million property and it goes for five instead of four, the numbers start to change pretty quickly. So, we are conservative in our estimates. Hopefully, for the sake of all shareholders, they're able to pay out 12, 13, or even 15. But we're being conservative because we recognize the risk reward doesn't seem to make sense. I don't know what they could have done differently. Ben Shaw, the previous CEO, just went and got a different job. Kind of just a very difficult business to be in. I think we all know Eddie Lampert selling his shares. If you own real estate, especially commercial real estate, and the Fed's trying to orchestrate sort of increased unemployment, recessions in the U.S., and raising interest rates, all three of those factors are going to have a negative impact on Seritage, multi-tenant retail in general, revenues in multi-tenant retail, and of course the rental rates that they're able to charge. So unfortunately, and it is unfortunate, we were very much looking forward. This was a large position. We were very much looking forward to getting $18 a share for our $12 stock. But as that started to deteriorate, it wasn't worth staying in the position.
Yeah. I just want to, just before we move on from Seritage, I'm just going to look through some of the Twitter questions I was going to ask.
Yeah, absolutely.
Most of these towards the end of the episode, but I might just pull out any on Seritage. I think we've probably covered most of it, to be honest. We did have a question, I guess, around, some of the charts that Seritage laid out and what they estimate their portfolio might look like over time. It looks like it is likely to get more concentrated towards their higher value properties. That seems like, those seem like the properties that will really move the needle for Seritage, from what I can gather, a small handful of really valuable ones. Do you agree with that view, and what's the valuation process been like on those larger, more complicated ones?
Great question. So what I will say, why don't I give you a few insights that we've had. Your viewers can take or leave any of these. I agree with everything you've said. I think this business update that was published, I believe, in February is quite informative, but it helps to evaluate the properties. One thing you'll notice first, there's a few things that are confusing. One thing you'll notice is that they suddenly have five more premier properties. So they went from, on the website, they have 78. We know they have a couple of they have 80, but suddenly they have 85. Where do those 85 come from?
Real estate equivalent of a stock split, I think, man.
Yes, that's exactly what happened. There's been any value creation whatsoever. All right. I think most likely what they've discovered is that it will be so difficult to sell a property for $80 or $100 million. They need to divide it up. So whether it's an out parcel or they've actually done some reorganizations, they may have taken a property from another category and started calling it Premier, and maybe they split off something from a Premier to fill in the old space. We don't know exactly what moved, but they didn't create new property. So we believe that the existing Premier values, however they're divided, will be accurate. Perhaps they can get a little bit more if they're selling them in as two instead of one. When you look at this year-end business update, and I will pull it up here to look at the same time, there's three main charts, and I think the bottom two are most relevant and interesting. Let's look at the last chart, saying, which is, I think, what your question relates to, selling smaller assets through market turbulence, selling larger assets later in the process. So what we know from this update here is that 17 of these were already sold. And I'm doing some of this by memory, but 17 were sold. And so they're not going to actually sell, you know, everything listed here. You don't get to double count. So they have 50 under 10, 24, you know, between 10 and 30 million, 30 between 30 and 50 million, and two over 50 million. We have sort of like a complex Sudoku puzzle. We've identified what we think will fill in those gaps, and we're very confident that they are not getting anywhere near a billion in sales this year. In fact, as is so common in real estate globally, but particularly I think in the US, is that you know, the people expect delays. So they put out this plan, and then some of these are going to slip into 2024. I don't think people would blame management actually for them, for the slippage. This is their, I think this is the best case scenario that they're presenting. And so I do think that some of these premier assets will be held not only until next year, but then will slip into the private trust. And I think it's very unlikely that we see a dividend payment in Q1 of next year. I think in Q1 of next year, they will still be paying the debt. And I believe that they will be taking these premier assets into the liquidation trust. And so valuing those properties will become essential. You know, Adventure is probably the most expensive. What will people pay? We think maybe it's worth $150 million. So if someone out there wants to come up with their own conclusions on Santa Monica and UTC, these are the valuable properties. And, you know, if they come up with high values, maybe there's an investment case.
Maybe one last question on Seritage Met before we roll into a couple of other topics here. I know you messaged me a few weeks ago to say that when you were still in Seritage, you owned a fairly substantial chunk of the company at that point. I know some of it was just straight up ownership. I have been long the shares, but you had a fairly significant exposure through selling puts as well. I think it was all up in the range of about 1% of the entire company. I guess, firstly, is that about right? And secondly, I guess my question here is, what's it been like sort of getting in and out of a company like Seritage, where you're presumably at this point like a fairly sizable chunk of the overall trading volume?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Tom. That is correct. You know, we run a pretty modest sized fund. It's growing. You know, earlier this year, we were getting up around 20 million AUM. So you can put that in context. If we have almost 1% of the shares, it's like a $6 million position. So it was large. And we have a concentrated portfolio, as you know. Mm-hmm. So in order to build that position, that wasn't difficult because it was done over a long period of time, usually by through the sale of puts. In fact, our cost base is quite low, maybe $5 or $6 a share. And we worked our way in over a long period of time. Selling was a little bit, or exiting was a little bit interesting. So we had some short puts, and we had some stock. I guess it wasn't as difficult as you'd imagine, but we had to have a small strategy. So, you know, we sold some calls as a tool to exit, you know, with sort of strikes a little above where we were. And we started buying back the puts. That's all plain vanilla. When we sold the shares, started selling the shares a couple weeks ago, it was, you know, we moved the price. I think you all saw us move the price pretty much. So, But we, you know, so when you have 1 or 2% of the shares, you start to move the price a little bit if there's a low volume business like this. So with Occidental, you can see Buffett's able to just accumulate like 25% of the whole company. The shares, of course, moved a little bit, but when you have a liquidating business where there's not a lot of free float out there, and the volume's relatively low, it is a little tough to exit. So it's good to use, I think, options to do it. So, you know, we've sold some calls, and frankly, we still have some, we still have some calls that we've written. And we expect those to just expire worthless, actually, because we won't receive any dividends between now and say January of 2024. So it took some calculating, but it wasn't too cumbersome. And I think our average price was over 11 when we were selling. Our average price is definitely in the 11s, and so I think we exited in a really good manner.
Yeah, nice. And is this sort of new territory for the fund as it's grown over the years, or have you been in similar?
Yeah, I don't think there's been a situation where we have a few holdings where we're large shareholders, but not something where we've tried to unwind things, and especially not look. Seritage used to be in what we were calling our infinite compounder category. When a business is growing, you have a lot more flexibility to be patient and to try to get a good price. This is quite the opposite. It's a situation where the business is shrinking and there's sort of this ticking clock, because management's going to come out with the information. People are going to soon have the information. It seems like there are very few people who have done the work to value these properties. It's surprising. You know, it is a little bit difficult, but it's just a mall with a cap rate. It's just there's a certain amount of NOI. You can figure it out. And if you go through and figure a few of them out, you might realize that they're going to sell for 38 rather than 100 million. And those absolute numbers will dictate exactly what we're paid out. And we don't see the payout coming in the $12, $15, $18 range. We see it much less.
Gotcha. All right, Matt, I think that was about as comprehensive of a Seritage update as we could possibly hope to do. So I really appreciate transparency on that. It's super valuable to have covered this probably, you know, over a long period of time. And I think people really appreciate it. So thank you for that. And I'm going to put a very large disclaimer at the start of this episode already, but please do your own work on this situation, people watching and listening. Let's move to Daily Journal Corporation. I know that's a company you've been in for some time. We recently had the Daily Journal annual meeting with I believe 99-year-old Charlie Munger at this point answering some questions, which I always enjoy. Let's pull out maybe a few things that happened in the DJ Co meeting that I want to get your thoughts on. Maybe let's start a little bit more DJ Co business oriented and then move to some of the things Charlie just said in the Q&A, which I thought were interesting. I believe this is the very first time we've seen, I think it's Stephen Michael Jones, the new CEO at DJ Co, kind of as part of the Q&A session. What's been your impression of him so far since kind of taking the helm at DJ Co?
I think we are so fortunate to have someone like Stephen come on board. I think it was Chris and Andrew who brought Stephen from the Tiny Fund, if you're familiar with them, who brought or alerted Charlie to Stephen. That's my understanding. And further understanding is that Charlie didn't quite know what to do with Daily Journal without finding Stephen. So, he's getting up there at 99 years old. By the way, he's still very sharp. Mentioned having another 6 years now that he's in a wheelchair. I don't know where he gets his actuary tables, but that sounds pretty good.
Yeah, I was going to say, we'll have to get you to get your book out again.
That's
like
right.
You did when we were in Austin. Yeah.
So I think, Daily Journal is a very special business, and the compounding that can take place over the next few decades is enormous. but we need someone like Stephen Myhill Jones to run this over, you know, without Charlie around. And so I think Charlie's alternatives were maybe to sell the business or to do something drastically different, which would have been devastating for us. We want to be owners of this firm. And so we're so pleased to have Stephen there. He's been quite successful with his own, I think it's a geology software firm in Canada. And I noticed recently in the filings that they opened up, Journal Technologies Canada. So there's a new business entity going on up in there, up in Canada. And I think we have just such a long runway with Daily Journal Co. It's growing. It's going to grow very quickly. I mean, Charlie says it will take a long time, and it will take a long time. It will take decades. But that's a great thing, because they are going to slowly, you know, we've been counting counties, and the more we watch the business develop, it seems like maybe we should be counting countries. And I think the potential here is enormous. The board is spectacular. Stephen Myhill Jones is going to be a great leader. And I hope he quickly changes his title from interim CEO to permanent CEO, yeah. Because we'd love to have him.
Yeah, very cool. And one of the things I most appreciate about you, Matt, is just the level of detail that goes into your analysis. I know when you were first getting started with DJ Co, I think you've shared stories on the podcast before of sitting in hotel lobbies at these conferences about how to use DJ Co software that they wouldn't let you into and all this stuff. And you're kind of trying to chat to people on the way through and track down all these hidden government contracts and various things. How are some of those projections been, playing out so far? I know you were digging into reasonably long-term contracts where I think DJ Co weren't actually going to get any revenue for several years in some cases from memory. And you're
there's a few interesting things that happened. So if I provided some insights over the years, Charlie says things like you can't teach the new dogs the old tricks. Yes. And it's quite interesting we've been a shareholder now for probably 4 or 5 years, and we will continue to be a shareholder for many more years. I think we own 0.5% of Daily Journal at the moment. And we're not, we have no intention of selling any Daily Journal. We'd love to buy more. So we've done a lot of in-depth research. And one thing that I recognize holding Daily Journal makes me a better investor. I sit there and I watch what Charlie Munger's doing all the time. I watch what the board members are doing. And so I myself try to implement those strategies. One thing that they're doing that's quite interesting is they're so focused on their current customer base that I question whether or not they're even planning to make a lot of money from the software itself, or whether this is just a new form of Costco subscription where you implement Daily Journal at a very low cost. It saves the county a ton of money. It adds, it's the best product, and it adds value. It creates an IRR on the investment from the courthouses. If in the long term their revenue is coming from shared revenue from society, that could be a great thing. So they are very focused on, really doing right by their current customers. And it's interesting that they're expanding in a sort of conservative manner and just trying to keep their current customer base happy. I think it's also very interesting that they're so segregated in the U.S. I think the U.S., they're getting these big contracts in Australia, and maybe they'll get future big contracts in other countries. But in the U.S., it's really segmented. And so I think that's a nice strategy they have, where they'll always be in the U.S. Some particular county could decide to switch and use Tyler Technologies product, the Odyssey product. But that won't mean that they're not in the U.S. So I think They have a really strong foothold in the US. It's basically an oligopoly. And then they're going to be expanding globally. I think the runway is so long, and the numbers are definitely being hit. So one thing I'll mention briefly, Tom, is that they recently discontinued their JustWear product. And I think that there's so many aspects of this that distort the numbers of the financial statements. And when I read them, I often chuckle because I realize that many people are missing things that are going on. So by discontinuing the JustWear service, they're encouraging them all to move to eSuites, which is the General Technologies product. And the JustWear discontinuation looks like a big revenue drop. But the revenues actually didn't decline in the financial statements. Because eSuites is growing so quickly, it looks like flat growth. So even though the revenue looks like it's growing at a somewhat muted level, I think it's maybe $35 million or so this year, eSuites is growing rapidly. 20 or more percent per year is a realistic figure, I think, at this point. And so originally we had this thesis that they're going to have $100 million in revenue by 2030. And we have 7 years to get there. And I still hold that thesis. I think they can make it. So, and that's just the beginning. And that's one of the many reasons we love Daily Journal. I mean, Daily Journal is very, very special. They have this very special. I'll answer any questions that you'd like to ask, Tom.
No, that's great, Matt. One of the things that inevitably comes up when we talk about DJ Co is obviously the big stock portfolio that Manga yeah. manages. I haven't done the maths probably in the last 6 months, but I think last time I did it, it was north of 50% of the market cap, and it may well be more as sort of represented by the stock portfolio.
Yes, that is definitely the case. They should have 300 or so. I'm immediately going to try and go and look it all up. But it's much higher than 50%. Okay. Probably the market cap is roughly maybe 300 million, something like that today. And, they have a little bit of debt, and their software business is maybe valued today at around 200 million. That might be the cost. Gotcha. X portfolio and ignoring the newspapers.
Gotcha. Well, I guess my underlying question is, you know, they've got this big stock portfolio, which I guess you can view it a couple of different ways. One way to look at it is it provides some margin of safety because you're effectively paying a lot less for the SaaS business. I guess the other way to look at it is every dollar you're putting into DJ Co, you know, some's going towards these bank stocks that it doesn't seem like are ever going to get sold, as far as I can tell from the way Charlie talks about it. And then some's going towards the SaaS business. I mean, would it be your preference to just invest in Journal Technologies if that was a possibility? Like, how do you think about that balance between the portfolio and the SaaS business?
Great question. Look, I'm happy because of management. I'm happy to be invested in Daily Journal Co. while they have this equity portfolio. I'm very comfortable that Charlie has been selecting these securities. I also don't think about it like a real security portfolio. First of all, I'll say a few quick thoughts. One, if Charlie Munger were running a hedge fund today with sort of a 0, 5, and 25/5 or 25/6 or whatever it is, people would be lined up to get into that fund. In this fund called Daily Journal Co., he's doing it for free. Charlie has never pulled any money out of Daily Journal Co. If he has a salary of any kind, it's like $5,000, something like what I think Mary Collin is being paid.
That's his annual peanut brittle budget, I hear.
Yeah. So he is looking to add all the value he can, not take any value out, and he's running an equity portfolio inside of Daily Journal. So already that would be attractive for a lot of people. However, I don't think the equity portfolio should be thought of in the same way. This is really their cash. this is, I mean, what you said is true, that it does provide a bit of downside protection, because I expect this equity portfolio will grow into the market cap of the whole business over the next couple of years. So your downside becomes very limited, which makes it attractive because you have this asymmetric long run potential compounding upside, and it's working, and a very muted downside. So that becomes very attractive. But the equity portfolio themselves, they've shown a willingness to just borrow against it. So they're getting very attractive rates on their margin loan that they're taking against this equity portfolio. And then they're using the dividends from Wells Fargo and Bank of America to service the interest on this debt. So this is a very unique sort of symbiotic relationship that the portfolio has with the software itself. So I don't really think they're distinct. I wouldn't want to just buy the software if it were a standalone company. Charlie Munger has talked about this, actually, that it would be difficult for them to compete with Tyler if they just had a little software and nothing else behind them to give these courthouses a confidence that Daily Journal will be sort of a going entity 10 years from now. So they use the equity portfolio to give themselves some size, some scale. They use it to borrow at very attractive rates compared to the rest of the market. And it just is going to sit there like a growing capital pool that they can access as they need capital. I think Charlie Munger has, Charlie Munger's mentioned this as well, but Daily Journal's a very wealthy company. They have way more assets and cash than they need to run the software. And so he's basically set up the structure so that it will grow faster than inflation, hopefully faster than the markets, not faster than the S&P 500. And then meanwhile, they'll use this capital pool to supercharge their software and get a toehold in countries all over the world in this really underserviced space. So both of them combined look very attractive.
Very interesting. I kind of like that perspective of viewing them as a bit of a symbiotic relationship, actually. I guess speaking a little more on the equity portfolio, I wanted to cover a couple of different investments with you, because mm-hmm. in some ways the DJ Co portfolio is a little bit of a black box. We obviously see the US holdings reasonably clearly in the 13F, but it's, you've sort of had to back into the BYD holding and potentially some other stuff that's in there. I guess just starting with maybe Alibaba initially, because that's been on everyone's mind in the past couple of years since Charlie bought that. It's just a damn retailer, Matt. What do you think about that?
In some regards, it is just a damn retailer, but it's an e-commerce retailer, and it does have cloud services, and it does have a huge venture portfolio. So we can unpack that a little bit. What you're referring to, obviously, is that Munger's, made headlines saying it was, I think, his worst investment ever.
Worst mistake ever, I think.
Biggest mistake, worst mistake. And I think people have misinterpreted that information a little bit. I think the first time he was buying, it was a mistake. He overpaid. The mistake was not in the business. The mistake was the price. So I don't recall if he paid sort of $200 a share, but it was up there around
$230 at least, I think.
$230 at least. Yeah. What happened then, as you'll recall, is he doubled down, maybe at a price around $100 or so, and then later sold the first purchase for tax write-off, and sort of confuse some people by doing it in that inverted way. I don't think his second buy was a mistake. So I think his first buy, he's notably saying it was his worst mistake ever, but he's still in Baba. The company is still good. When you get a different price, you have a different you have it, you can have a different investment opportunity. So at a lower price, it's not the same mistake. And if you think about it, the price of Baba is like half, or even less than half it was 5 years ago. And it's actually, I think, below the IPO price. So, I find his position pretty attractive. It just generally, I think it's really controversial, but he'll talk, you know, China's growing at 5%. The US is growing at less than 1%. And we're about to put it into a recession, and which means it'll have negative GDP growth. There's a lot of tailwinds, I think, that are encouraging this position for him in China. And, you know, the future will, I think we will find that he is right in the long run.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see how that plays out. I know I listened to the Alibaba conference call last week, maybe, and yeah, they were talking about 5% GDP growth. But it was interesting to dig into the components of that GDP. It sounds like that mix is sort of changing. This is just off the top of my head, could be wrong, but I think it's something in the ballpark of 38% of China's GDP is consumption versus more like 68% in the United States. So, if they get the underlying 5% growth plus that mix changes a little bit, there's sort of a couple of the different growth engines there, I guess, for Alibaba.
Yeah, absolutely. The demographics are switching, changing rapidly. In fact, there's even, it's even things like internet penetration has not reached a full equilibrium level in China. I think there's like maybe 75% or so internet penetration, and they expect it to stabilize at 94% over the next 5 years. It's like, you know, the demographics are changing as consumers have more disposable income. There's tailwinds coming from GDP growth. There's tailwinds coming from a shift to e-commerce or even accepting e-commerce generally. You know, internet penetration. There are a number of factors, all tailwinds. As far as I can tell, for something like Baba. And so it does look pretty promising. And I think Charlie's big mistake was overpaying. I think it's more than a retailer. I think it'll do pretty, I think it'll do very well. You know, the cloud space is going to be enormous down the road.
Yeah. Maybe just a slight change here, looking maybe at more of kind of the black box part of the portfolio that there's obviously a lot less certainty on kind of what's in there. We know DJ Co owned BYD for a long time. There's been a bit of speculation on Twitter and the likes that he perhaps owns Tencent now as well.
I think you can back into that. You can back into that. So if you just compare the prices over the last two quarters with their financial statements and the 13F filings, and you can back into it that they do own Tencent. You know, so Tencent and Baba are both positions, and I think both great positions, actually. They'll do very well. They're compounding, they're growing. And I think there's, in both cases, it over a few years, we, you know, the CCP is doing all sorts of things. There's challenges, but over a few years, I think with both Tencent and Baba, there is very little, almost no real chance of it being lower in value. I mean, these businesses are growing in value on a daily basis. And so I think long run, there's upside and very, very little downside to that portfolio.
Yeah, watch the space. And do you think he still owns BYD? Any thoughts there?
I was under the impression that they're exited BYD. Okay.
Presumably a price thing, because he seems to absolutely love the business and the management.
But absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's just too expensive. Yeah.
Okay. Awesome. Cool. Any final thoughts on...
Somebody will add in the comments if I've got that wrong, but I do think they exited BYD.
Yeah. Any final thoughts on DJ Co, Matt, before we maybe jump to some Twitter questions?
Final thoughts. I don't, you know... Look, we hold this position. It's sort of tough to talk about current holdings because you get into situations like with Seritage where we were a holder, now we're not. And, you know, it's hard to get that information out. But you look, Daily Journal Co. in general, it's truly one of, I think it's a really outstanding business, and it will take a long time, but it's incredible when you get this incredible board. I think, by the way, I will make one comment that after this meeting, I don't know if you noticed this, Tom, but I found a lot of risks that I had previously addressed in some of my presentations were being commented on and addressed by both Stephen and Charlie. Things that were bothering people seemed a little insignificant at times, like not having a 401k or a solid career path. And Charlie actually talked about that. They're implementing a 401k and he's not letting anyone select individual securities. He said you can do index only 401k. But these subtle things help with employee morale. It helps with sort of encouraging employees to stay on and have a career path. So things are great at Daily Journal and they're getting better. I think it's just a wonderful place to be there. If you remove the equity portfolio, you're buying into something that's trading for maybe 5 or 6 times revenue. It's attractively priced. It's a great business model and it has, you know, some of the best management team that exists on the planet. So, or maybe even in history. It's a pretty unique situation to be in. I like it a lot. It's a great compounder.
Continues to be probably the lowest percentage of actual shareholders in a shareholder meeting, I would think.
Absolutely.
Of any company. Yeah.
That's right. Sure.
All right. Let's jump over to some Twitter questions to maybe wrap this one up, Matt.
Absolutely.
We've got a lot on Seritage. I think we've covered about as much as we possibly can then. So I'll try to pick out some others here where we can. We've got a couple of questions on structured dividend capture. I know that's something you've talked through at some of your annual meetings and that type of thing.
Yeah.
So this is a three-parter. So I'll maybe just run through each of these and tackle the bits that you want to. How many stocks?
Who asked the question, by the way?
This is Devin Toogood on Twitter. So how many stocks does Matt hold at a time in his basket while running structured dividend capture? Does Matt avoid holding multiple businesses in the same industry while running structured dividend capture? What are the most prevalent dangers / risks to be mindful of?
Okay, great. So we have software now that's doing a lot of this for us. So we've developed code with Python. And so we can manage a lot more data probably than most people. But we do a 13F analysis that covers about 100 different funds. And, you know, we identify about 30 to 40 firms that will work for us each quarter. And we're cycling through those typically over a 2-week period. So definitely we have, you know, 5 or 6 in a basket at once for a given week and over a 2-week period. So we might have like 10 in the portfolio at a given time. And I find the basket is a really effective way to do things. The biggest risk is that everything comes down at once. So we don't see that happen very frequently. And you never know when it's going to happen. So that's a part of the challenge. And when you think it's going to happen, that's not the right time. So you need to sort of be consistent with your implementation to get the desired outcome. I think behaviorally, we would probably make the performance less by trying to deviate from what we've determined to be optimized. So we have about 30 companies per quarter. Although I will share with you, this is for Devin and anybody else. I'm recognizing that there might be an attractive enough opportunity if you have 5 or 10 companies that you really follow and like. If the ex dividend dates are, you know, not completely aligned, you might do well just by rolling through your own favorite securities. And then by being more familiar with them, I think it gives you more comfort and confidence when the share prices decline. So as we're getting to know these, it's just hard to, we definitely don't know these 30 or 40 like we know Daily Journal Co. or Seritage. And so the risk is actually that the market drops and you lose a bit on everything and you don't quite make up for the declines with your premiums and dividends. So you need to be prepared for that. That happens. In our back testing, we saw that happening about once every 5 years in a pretty big way. We sort of saw some of that happening at the end of last year. So we saw things coming down a lot and some of our structured dividend capture. In fact, we took a loss on it because it was the premiums and dividends were not making up for the rapid decline in share prices across the whole basket. So that's rare, but it happens. And hopefully that answered the questions. Did I get all three?
I think so. Yeah. We've got another question here from at CJ Kern one on Twitter. I think this probably ties into the previous question, but CJ says, Matt mentioned previously he identifies the company he likes and keeps buying more and more as new money flows in, but he's a value investor. What does he do when the price runs on his companies? Does he sit in cash? Is that basically just refer to previous strategy?
Well, that's right. So we can always find a new opportunity. And we have these sort of, we've labeled them internally as these infinite compounders because we have no intention of selling them. Of course, a lot of times some of them have pretty consistently good buying prices. Daily Journal Co. just seems like it's consistently a good buy. So you can allocate capital to a number of positions. We haven't really had trouble allocating to our deep value opportunities. Although if the prices run up, we're not going to overpay and we will run the money through the structured dividend capture strategy where we're writing puts on these abnormally high dividend payers, collecting a premium. And if we get the shares before the ex-dividend date, we get the dividend and then we exit with a call. We can run a lot of capital through that strategy. And we expect to earn sort of 15 to 20% on that strategy. But that short-term capital gains, it's actually a little bit of work. It's a little bit of work for me. It's a little bit of work for our analysts. There's more activity. We would prefer to have a long-term compounder growing at 20% a year and just watch it grow. But if we don't have that available, we will definitely put the capital right through the structured dividend capture and be making up those gains while we're looking for the new long-term opportunity to allocate to.
Got it. It's about as good a alternative sort of growth engine for what would otherwise be idle cash as you could probably ask for. So I like
that's
it
right.
Let's go with one last question. This is from Luis, who is a longtime subscriber of the channel and met in Omaha. Let's finish on this one because this is a better question than I could ever hope to ask you, Matt. How can one get a hold of Matt in Omaha? His parties are notoriously famous.
Okay. Great question. So look, anybody can send me an email, matthew.peterson@petersonfunds.com. You can find me on Twitter. I think it's Matt Peterson CFA. You can also, if it's specifically about the barbecue, you can write to andrew.park@petersonfunds.com. We'll be getting those invitations out, in the next month or so. But we do have on Thursday before Berkshire, we do host a casual backyard barbecue. And it's really fun to connect with people there. And get to know some new faces, see some people that we've been maybe corresponding with over social media, meet people in person like you, Tom. So we'd love to have people there. It's just casual casual backyard barbecue in Omaha.
Yeah, highly recommend the barbecue. That was definitely one of the highlights of the Berkshire weekend.
thank you, Tom.
Matt, I think that's about all the questions I've got for today. We covered a heck of a lot in that episode, so I really appreciate you making the time again. You already mentioned your Twitter and a few links and things there, but is there anything else you want to plug or anywhere people should go to get in touch with you?
Look, we have a few things out there now. We have a YouTube channel that people can go and look at. I think there are, Tom, we've been running the fund for almost 12 years, so there's got to be close to 50 letters on our website. There's quite a bit of information out there. And if people want to talk further, they're interested in the fund, whatever it is, they can reach out to me and we'd be happy to set up a conversation.
Awesome. Cool. Matt, let's wrap it up there. Thank you so much for your time. We'll have to get you back for round four at some point. I think people like to have you on the show. So you'll definitely be coming back if you get back the time.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here. You ask great questions. I think you've got a lot of followers and you do a great job. So I appreciate it.
Awesome. Thanks so much. Thanks for watching another episode of the Investing with Tom podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe so that you can see future episodes as soon as they go live.